Hey there, friends. This is Paul Carter. I'm the lead pastor of Cornerstone Baptist Church in Orillia. I'm an executive council member with TGC Canada and the host of the End of the Word podcast. We are doing a very special episode today, specifically for the TGC conference in Vancouver, Canada, April 22nd to 24th. So a big welcome to everyone watching on from there. Our topic for this episode is pastoral development. We've probably all heard the statistics. 25% of all current pastors are planning to retire in the next 6 months. 50% of pastors have considered quitting since 2020. 85% of new pastors quit within the first 5 years. The boomers are retiring, and there aren't nearly enough Gen X pastors coming up behind them to fill all those gaps. The millennials are quitting in record numbers, and the Gen Zs aren't signing up in the first place. So we have a problem, and I think everybody understands that. Pastoring is hard, and we have fallen behind on recruiting, development, and support. So here to fix that problem for us is my good friends, Paul Martin and Stephen Bray. Brothers, thanks for being with us, and welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you, buddy.
Yeah, no pressure. You just don't feel any pressure with having to fix this problem in the next 20 minutes. Let's start, though, with why it is hard for young men to take up the call for pastoral ministry in the current moment. What obstacles are they facing that maybe men our age did not face when we are making our way in? Paul, let's start with you, and we'll just kind of rally back and forth.
Yeah, I think you could, like, right off the bat, I just consider there's so many societal, cultural obstacles that we may not even consider as obstacles. But when I was a young man, you know, if you were getting married at 23, that was kind of late. What are you waiting for? There was a clear path, finish high school, get a degree, move on, have babies with your wife that you're going to stay with for your whole life. That was the cultural milieu into which I was born. I'm grateful for it now as I look back upon it. It was rare that, you know, my friends were living in with one parent, like in divorced homes. That was just kind of unheard of in my sort of circle. So I just think right off the bat, there was this sort of these boundaries or walls that were sort of pushing us in a certain direction. And then now when I look at, you know, just broader society and think, I think one sin that we don't maybe think enough about is the sin of idleness, like I-D-L-E, idleness, just a kind of overall lack of gumption, getting things done, the plague of pornography that is just having a lot of guys waste their 20s and into their 30s. The just cost of living is another factor. It's harder. Everything's a lot harder in that sense. So I'm just talking in those areas. I think right off the bat, you've got obstacles, things to overcome. But if you read a little bit of history, you realize that lots of people have had even more difficult things and they found a way to do it.
Yeah, it was interesting. You were talking there about just kind of a delayed adulthood. Jean Twenge in her book Generations talks about the slow life strategy that by and large now, she's saying that young people are reaching adult milestones about 7 to 10 years behind where they did in our generation. And so either you guys remember who wrote the book, Why Johnny Can't Preach?
That's a good one. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I can't remember either. But anyway, he talks about the same thing. Like, at the end of the day, kids come out, young people come out of a cultural context. They come out of an educational context. And today's cultural context is not really positioning people to jump into a ministry like pastoral ministry that has, you know, huge personal stresses, that demands a fair bit of mental focus, that suggests that you ought to have read 600 books instead of, you know, endless scrolls on YouTube. And I don't even know if the endless scroll on YouTube is a thing, but endless scroll on Instagram or whatever, that kind of cultural context. And think of the lack of social interactions that young people raised in this cultural context are experiencing. We spent a lot of time talking to older people when we grew up. And ministry requires you to be able to talk to a variety of people. And if you have spent most of your life sending texts and emojis to people, as opposed to having eye-to-eye conversations, that's going to be a challenge. So yeah, there's a cultural context that's making it harder. Absolutely. You mentioned economic factors as well. For those of you listening on who maybe don't know who these two brothers are, I should say a little bit about them. Paul Martin is a pastor in Toronto and has a long-standing ministry and developed habit of developing young leaders. And so that's why I've invited him here. And then Stephen Bray is working on the, I was going to say East Coast, but of course you're further away than even the East Coast, the island in the middle of the sea, working in Newfoundland, and also just a real habit, a real commitment to leadership development and church planting. So two guys that I really want your perspective on this. So Stephen, talk a little bit about this issue. Why is it harder for young men to get on the on-ramp to get into ministry nowadays?
Yeah, one thing, by the way, it was Thomas Gordon is your author.
Oh, thank you,
brother. Why Johnny Can't Preach. One thing you guys mentioned it, and Paul alluded to pornography. Guys, I got to tell you, I actually think one of the things we're not giving enough credence to is how much these young men are spending on video games and anime. And like, I'm not talking just social media. I'm talking about this whole artificial world now. If I had a nickel for every time I've said to a kid under 25, if you knew your Bible the way I hear you talk about Fortnite and Dungeons and Dragons and all these types of things, like, you'd be a godly young man. If I saw them having that passion. So I think we don't realize. If I can flip it around, I think one of the things that we need to take responsibility for, I'm a product of the, kind of a very conservative, independent Baptist church upbringing from 5 years old on. And in the 80s and 90s, pastors actively and regularly called men to ministry. And I think the bad result of that was a whole bunch of dudes that didn't belong in ministry went into the ministry. And instead of acting, we reacted. And it feels like from 1995 to 2015, it's like nobody was called to ministry. I never heard that appeal from a pulpit. I never saw anybody of my peer group that had any kind of plan. They just thought it'll all happen supernaturally. And I think we're now reaping some of the fruit of that, where we have not just challenged these young men that are in our churches as God calling you to something that's bigger than yourself. So I think I think it's one of those two. In the East Coast, between the video game phenomena, I would say right now I'm dealing more with video game obsession than even pornography or a form of pornography that's wrapped into these video games. And then just a general lack of calling men out in a good way. I'm not talking that alpha male way, but I mean in a real, real decent way.
Yeah. Jonathan Haidt in the book that came out earlier this month, The Anxious Generation, talks about this phenomenon at some length. He refers to I think it's called the hikikomori or something like this, this Japanese term that has now gone mainstream here, of young men who just have retreated into their bedrooms, closed the door. They push their laundry out and mom takes care of it. And other than that, they live their lives online. Some of them have found ways to make money online. Some of them are just being supported by their parents. Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon. And to a certain extent, I'm sure that may play a role in the lack of preparedness to engage the on-ramp. And then, Paul, you mentioned the economic realities. I feel like that is maybe an underappreciated factor. I know for myself, when I started ministry in 1994, I got married in 1996, and we were able to, have an apartment. In fact, I think when we started, we even had two cars. We eventually went down to one car, but we were able to have an apartment and a car. And I was in seminary more or less full time my first year while working as a part-time youth pastor, and my wife was nannying. And I don't remember that being terribly stressful. I mean, we certainly didn't have a ton of money, but we were able to pull that off pretty easily. Economic realities are not in line with that picture anymore today. And so for a young person to say, well, I'm going to have to go $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 in debt to graduate from seminary, then I'm going to, take a job in a church and get paid $50,000, and housing in that community is going to be $2,300 for an apartment a month or $700,000 to buy a house. Like, these numbers, they don't work. And so a shocking number of young guys have graduated from seminary and not gone into ministry. because there's just no financial way for that to work. Are you guys seeing that? I mean, Paul, I mean, I would imagine in Toronto, that's a factor. And then Stephen, I don't know if that's a factor on the east side of the country.
It's definitely a factor here. I mean, you said 700,000. I giggled. I'm like, oh, for anything for 700,000 in the city.
That's a garage in Toronto.
Yeah. But I totally agree with what you're saying, Paul, and it is a legitimate thing. When you were reflecting on your earlier years, right, I might reflect on mine and say, you know, we had no way. We were poor. Like, we didn't have a way to get to seminary, and we prayed about it for a year, and God miraculously provided through this woman who'd never married in Indiana that we barely knew, that cut me a check for 10 grand and said, I heard you want to go to seminary. And that kind of like set us on a trajectory. When you read Luke 12, where Jesus is, you know, seek my kingdom, seek his kingdom, his righteousness first, and all these things will be added to you. Mm-hmm. I think that plays into this bit as well. I'm looking for young couples who are willing to say, you know, we'll live within our means, which means we will live very differently than the rest of the world. We'll not have all the nice things, and we're going to watch our neighbors drive nicer cars, and we're not going to run up our, you know, debt, and we're going to wait and see how the Lord provides. And he is capable, right? Like we know it. We've seen it enough time in our own lives. And then when you get to pastor people, you see it again and again. So I maybe want to say that would be the call that I want to put out to young guys. Like, don't spiral yourself into endless debt, obviously, but there are ways to wait on the Lord and then have the Lord provide.
Yeah, that's good. Let's talk a little bit about in-house development. I'd like to hear from both of you in terms of what you're doing to train up young men in your church to serve as, first of all, as elders and deacons. And then I would assume kind of out of that, some guys are going to catch the call, as Stephen has said, to go on to pursue vocational ministry in some sense. So what are you doing in-house to develop leaders? Stephen, let's start with you this time.
Yeah. So, you know, having said what I just said earlier about the call, I made it a habit when I came back to Newfoundland to, you know, at least consciously talk to the people of my church about God's call to ministry. And when I would go meet with young men, and I've always had a burden for men. And so I've always done early morning Bible studies. I've always tried to hang out with young guys. So when the guys are either coming out of high school or they're about second or third year university, I'll usually make a habit of going out with them, kind of that special thing. We'll take them out for a steak and do something with them and really ask them, okay, so what is life? Like, what's the plan and why? And have you ever thought about, and what would you say to God if you felt God was calling you to this? And what if I said to you that I see this hunger in you, and I, you know, have you ever considered it? I remember speaking to one of my guys who's about to become a church planter. He was in third year university, and he was thinking about either the military or the RCMP or becoming a lawyer, but he was hungry for the word of God. He was always nipping at my heels about how to be involved in church, and can I help you with this, and can I help you with that? And I remember asking him, okay, so what about, like, you've got this wonderful desire, you know, as a lawyer, what do you think the challenges are going to be living out your Christianity as a lawyer, this and that? And then I got into talking about Paul, got into his finances. How much debt are you in? What's important to you? All that kind of stuff. And then I think the other thing is, for me then, leading my elders and my deacons and my church, both in my preaching and in all that, to say to them, we need to deliberately create systems by which we are on purpose discipling the next generation, not for the future, but involving them in the here and now, which is messy. It's going to butt up generations. It's going to mean stuff happens quickly and then not so quickly. And there's as much failure as there is success. I just think it's about prepping the church. Everybody wants to raise up the next generation. Everybody says it's like, you know, every one of us, everybody wants change. Oh, we want change until it happens. And they're like, no, but that's not what I meant. And people say, I want to develop the next generation. Well, that's costly, timely. You'll get a lot of heartbreak. You know, you got to, you know, when Paul says about these young men counting the cost, I would say to us as pastors, we need to count the cost of the sacrifices we need to make. My life is not balled up in this cute little schedule that I like if I'm going to be around the next generation. And they're going to dump stuff on me and use language I don't know, and I'm going to be uncomfortable, and I got to call them to stuff. Yeah. So I think for me, I just I know, I still remember, I'm still young enough to remember acutely the one or two or three men that poured into me and the difference it made in my life. And I've gone back to those men to ask them, why me? And then I discovered, like you said, Paul, about your dad. Then I discover, hey, Steve, there were seven like you and only two of you made it. And then you hear the heartache, but yet they never gave up. And I think that's what I'm more stubborn about now than ever before, is if we're going to develop the next generation. I mean, Paul had, what did he have? He had Silas, but he had the heartbreak of John Mark. He had, you know, he had Titus and Timothy, but he had the heartbreak of Demas. And that's the great apostle Paul. But he didn't say, I'm going to stop taking men with me because I've had one guy flake out. I mean, another guy forsook me. He stayed at it.
Yeah, good. I realize it's probably complicated for the listeners to realize the two of us are here named Paul, and then we keep referring to the apostle Paul. Yeah. We probably have to differentiate. Tall Paul, yeah, we'll figure it out. So Tall Paul, Paul Martin, what are you doing to develop in-house leaders in your church?
Well, what we're doing now is very different than what we did when we planted the church 24 years ago. And I wanted to get to this because I think it could be helpful.
Yeah,
I don't think the systems that we use, like Steve talked about, they'll vary. You know, that'll vary on budget, church size, staffing, right. All that kind of stuff. But we planted the church, and this is not like, I don't tell the story a lot, but there were six of us when we planted, and right off the bat, I was mentoring the next guy. Mm-hmm. So that's because, as Stephen said, I had guys that had mentored me. There were some really influential men who just, you know, got in my kitchen, so to speak. Let's help you figure out how to live your life in a godly way. Let's train you in the things of God. And so that's kind of, I thought, well, I guess that's what you do. What has shocked me through the years is the number of pastors who lead very exclusive lives and then are looking around at the end of their ministry, kind of surprised that there's no one to take their spot. So I want to just put a word out that the responsibility, I think, falls on the pastor. It's 2 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, right? This is these things you entrust to faithful men. This is not an optional part, like some guys are good at it, some are not. And what Stephen said is so important because I have a long list of, you know, success stories, and I have a long list of not success stories. Yeah. That's not why we do it. We do it because we're called to do it, and we leave the results up to the Lord. So early on, you know, it's funny to think about it now. When we were a little church plant, and I was working 30 hours a week at a steel company and preaching two sermons and leading a prayer meeting, which was nuts, had three kids at home. And so sometimes in the middle of the service, I would just throw it to my young mentor and say, he's going to now lead us in the pastoral prayer. No preparation, no anything. I don't know what to do next. So you've got that kind of mentoring. So now we have a very formal kind of mentoring. We bring guys in. It's basically a semester long. They're here in the office. We pay them to come and be our intern. We're teaching them ecclesiology and preaching. So my view is that can't really be learned very well in most seminaries. And so I think that really ought to be taking place in the life of the church. Guys get out of seminary. They've never seen a members meeting. They don't know how to run an elders meeting. They don't have any clue about setting an agenda or goals or reporting or minutes, just stuff that is useful to know. So we bring them in. We make you read a ton of stuff. You write a paper. I meet with them for 3 hours every week. And then they're just around the office. Take them with us wherever we can go, different things. So that's now. It's different than what it was. It's what we can do at this point.
Amen. For us here, we have a bit of a pathway that we've developed. We call it the Barnabas Program. I would call that the meat or the center, the core of our program. So we run that in three cycles, B1, B2, B3. And we call it Barnabas Program because Barnabas was the guy in the New Testament who appears to be interested in leadership development. So with B1, we focus on the character of a leader. So usually 8 to 10 weeks, we'll walk them through. And right now, we have about 25 guys in the middle of this process. So they're in B2. So we did B1 together, go through the character of a leader, focus on that. What does it look like to lead yourself and to lead your family, et cetera, et cetera. In B2, we focus on evangelism and teaching. So it's doctrine, teaching, preaching, et cetera, et cetera. And we're doing that right now. And we bring in, we try to create live scenarios. So I always say we bring in real live pagans for practice. So we have a university in town and a college. So, and we get some of our Christian kids to recruit some of their non-Christian friends. And since so many of them are international students now, it's a fantastic opportunity. In our last go round, we brought in a Hindu lady, a Muslim fellow, and an atheistic Hindu. It was fantastic. And our guys loved it. We set them up at a table and they talked and tried to share the gospel, and it was fantastic. And then we do in the second semester, which we're in right now for B2, we do preaching. And so we get them, first of all, we teach them how to do it, and then we give them opportunities and critique, et cetera. And then B3 for us is specifically elder prep. So we learn the bylaws, we study our statement of faith, we talk about conflict management, how to do discipline, et cetera. So that's kind of what we do in-house. And then interestingly, that guys in that program will catch the call. And so we have two pastoral interns on staff with us right now that have come through that program. So it's, for us, it's a both and approach. Like, while we're developing in-house leaders, guys catch the call and begin transitioning into ministry. And both of those guys are on an on-ramp, a pretty short on-ramp into full-time vocational ministry. And then at the bottom end, we do summer internships and things like that with younger people to catch their interest and whatnot. So that's kind of what we're doing. Just a quick question. I hadn't thought to ask this, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'd be interested to hear from either of you. What are the advantages and disadvantages of being a smaller or larger church with respect to leadership development? We're trying to have our cake and eat it too. We're a larger church, but we're also involved in planting and satellite ministries. Like, so we just because of our geographical location, we support some smaller works. And so all throughout the summer, we've got a number of churches who ask us to send preachers. So we tend to have opportunities to send guys out. But the drawback of a larger church, of course, is that it's sometimes there are expectations that are harder for a guy in his first week out of school to meet. And so sometimes I look at the smaller church and I think, it might be easier to do leadership development there. Like, Paul, you talked about just throwing a guy into the deep end and say, come on up and do the pastoral prayer. There's a part of me I think that's great. There's another part of me that says, I'm not sure how often I could pull that off here. Either of you want to jump in on that?
Well, I would say for me, I think context, I'm here on the far east coast, as you said, on an island where there's very little what I would call good quality evangelicalism. I'm the only Reformed Complementarian Baptist church in all of St. John's outside of the churches we're planting. We're a small church. We have under 100 in our membership, 150 people attending, whatever. So I, like Paul, but I've laid the DNA in our church to that we are a teaching hospital unapologetically. Right. So my people, whether they start to attend our church on that first Sunday, they've been a part of our church. They know, hey, you're going to see rookies and mavericks. Like, they're just, it's going to be around. We're a nursery from beginning to end, so to speak. Right. And we're developing people, and that's how we do it. So that DNA has been built there. I do think you're right, Paul, about the bigger churches. As a guy who's also, our ministry with Mile One, we're asking churches to support us. I mean, your church, Paul Carter, supports us. And I do tell some of the larger churches, because they'll say to me, we intern guys too. And I'm like, I love you, and I appreciate what you're doing. But if a guy interns at a church of 1,500, that's like, being invited into the captain's quarters of the Titanic. And yet then saying to him, now go sail this tugboat.
That's a complicated metaphor.
Maybe the Titanic was a bad.
Sorry, Carter.
Yeah. But I do think you're right. There are unique challenges and privileges of a smaller church, medium church, larger church in numerically that I think. And I also think context. If I was in your world where you've got multiple churches that you guys can fellowship with and buildings and stuff, but then you guys have unique challenges that I don't have.
Yeah. Did you want to add anything to that, Paul, or should we?
Yeah, I think I just agree with everything Bray said. I think each situation is different. The thing is faithfulness in your situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Here's a question I'm eager to get your feedback on. A couple of us have mentioned debt already. I think both of you brothers mentioned debt, and that is an issue. And so I guess the question is this: if we could start from scratch, or if you could start from scratch and develop a pastoral development process from start to finish, what role, if any, would brick and mortar seminaries play in that? And then what role would be played by the local church? Because the way we're doing it right now seems to produce young men with $80,000 in debt who have spent very little time in the local church, who are ill-prepared, and sometimes just with that burden of debt and what we talked about, the price of housing, there's a failure to launch. Like, a lot of them just come out of seminary and they have to get a job in the industry, a job in the marketplace, I should say, just in order to service their debt. So should we reimagine this? And if we do, what would it look like? Paul, why don't we start with you?
Yeah. So I'm speaking as a guy who, did residential education. So I was at seminary, and I think there's huge benefits to that. I've not done any online, coursework, so I can't speak experientially to it. I know what the advantage was of sitting in a Hebrew class and going, hold on a second, Dr. Doolittle, can you explain that? Yeah, as opposed to watching some video. Now, maybe the classes are more interactive, that type of thing. I know what I can't teach my young guys. I can't teach them Hebrew. I can't teach them Greek. I could maybe do systematics, but I don't really have time to do it well. I think where I can help them is on the ecclesiological side, on the actual ministry of the word side, that type of thing. So I've always thought, what I would love is for, I don't think, that's not what I did. I went off to school and decided that I was going to be a pastor, which I don't recommend. I just didn't know better. I think the church is the one who calls pastors, not ourselves. But all that being said, I think what I long for is to have a more cooperative relationship with some of our existing seminaries and say, hey, I used to teach pastoral theology. I used to teach English Bible classes. I used to teach that in your seminary. Let me teach those here, and you give them credit for it. And then they'll do their languages and their systematics with you because you've got experts there and they need to be trained by experts. I'm not convinced that learning how to use Logos or Logos, whatever it is the same thing as like learning a language and being able to be proficient with it. Mm-hmm. So you do the stuff that you can do. We'll do the stuff that we can do. And that can be cooperative and really effective. So that would be kind of my dream.
Yeah, that's good. Steven?
You know what? I feel like I'm a James 1 guy here, man. I'm a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So personality-wise, I benefit greatly from the brick-and-mortar seminary experience. I thrive off groupthink. I process information verbally. Being able to be around people in a classroom, I thrive. I've been around other guys that's not what they need. So there was a time I was very pro brick and mortar. Then it seemed I came back east and I saw the lack of it. And then the enormous expenses of sending people, many of them didn't come back. The ones who did came back had a head full of stuff and no practical understanding. And then there was I was drawn more to, okay, we got to reimagine this thing. And, listening to Paul, I do think it's more in the middle. It's a both and, not an either or. In regards to your original question, though, in regards to the debt, here's what I will say. We need to start talking to these young men in our local churches as they come out of high school and they're going to go into something because they're debt-free then. And I just find we wait till they're in the debt to talk to them about the debt. So I just had a meeting this morning with some of my elders about how we're going to bring money talk into our young adults group and into our high school seniors group about, you guys go down this road and you make these decisions to be impulsive. This is what's going to happen. And, and then again, churches, we have these missions budgets and stuff. Are we willing to put a portion of our missions money into helping some of these men, young men, go to seminary? You cover a semester, we'll help you with a semester. But the idea of calling them back, I think we've always imagined missions as foreign. And we haven't realized that missions is Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. And that's not often reflected in the budget of being deliberate for the next generation.
Yeah, 100%. And I love that idea of talking to the students, but also talking to the churches. This has got to be a collaborative solution. I don't think you can just say to a young person, find a way to get your education without going into debt. Like we also have to say to churches, if you want pastors 20 years from now, develop a budget to help young people pay for seminary, because that's important. Paul?
Yeah, Paul, I'm just thinking like our latest hire was a young guy. He's finishing seminary. And part of what we did is say, hey, come work for us part time. We'll pay for your last year of school. You'll finish school and then you'll come. You'll just slip right into full time work with us. So that's another option, too, is
100%.
It's hard to find good guys. So if we find them, we try to get them.
Yeah, we have a scholarship program here where they have to apply for it. But if they are pursuing ministry, and if they have been involved here, we have a little bit of a formula that we develop, and we support them pretty generously. And like our current youth pastor, for example, is a guy that got saved in our youth ministry at 16, went away to Bible school, has been doing seminary, and we have been a major supporter of him. Our church planter that we sent out with our plant, same story. He came here as our music intern, caught the preaching bug, went to seminary the whole bit, and we supported him all the way through that. And now he's a lead pastor. So I think churches have to commit to that for the long haul. Go ahead, brother.
Paul, which I think would be useful to get out before we break, is the idea that if you become a church like this, because I think what you just said there is important, you're going to start losing guys.
Yeah.
You have to have a willingness to have sort of kingdom vision. So like, we've lost three.
Especially
elders.
If you send them to seminary in the States. Not that I'm still bitter about that.
Yes. Okay. What I'm saying is we're sending out elders. We're sending out church planners. I've had my staff, you know, poached by other churches. It's not poaching, but yeah, if you're going to be a church that raises up men, then you better be prepared to lose those men to other
100%. Churches. Yeah, that's a good, and it's both fortunate and unfortunate. I mean, the reality is if you're training up good people and the church next door isn't, and then they have a vacancy, guess who they're calling? Of course.
That's right.
It's great. So it's good for the kingdom of God. But it would be great if everyone was doing it, because if only some people are doing it, that's less ideal. Yes. In terms of just answering my own question on the development pathway, one of the things I'd like to see, very similar to what you said there, Paul, about recognizing that there are certain things that the seminary could do. Like you, I mean, I took Greek and Hebrew in seminary. I feel reasonably competent there, but I definitely could not teach it. And I'm not sure you can learn that online. So I think that there should be, you know, whether it's month-long modules where students are taking those sorts of things from the professionals in the place with the books and the library and all that, great. But I think we need to move towards more of a module approach where students are on the campus, you know, for a month, a year doing this sort of stuff, but the rest of the time doing what can be done online, doing that online and doing it in churches, so that they can have the apprenticeship model. I think that whatever you're learning not in the church, you're going to have to adapt to the church anyway. So just doing the majority of that stuff in the church, I think would be a really helpful model. Not unlike how they do it in the trades. Like if you're trying to get licensed as an electrician, you're working alongside of an electrician. You're going home and reading your textbook and studying some stuff. And then you're going down to Scarborough or Etobicoke or wherever to do a month-long intensive. And then you're right back on the job. Well, that's the way they do it. And I think that's the way probably we should look at doing it. It would probably cut the cost in half. So that would be my recommendation. And hopefully we'll see that kind of stuff happening in the future, because this graduating from seminary with $80,000 in debt is just not a good idea, given the financial realities that most of us are facing. At this point, we're going to sort of have a little mini break. It won't feel like a break to those of you who are listening, but we will end this portion of the podcast, and I will take questions and interact a little bit at TGC Vancouver with those who are gathered for this workshop. But we're going to carry right on for those who are listening as in the podcast form, and I'm going to get a little bit of each of your stories here, brothers, in terms of your own development pathway, because I think that will be helpful as well. All right, so let's carry on with that. Paul, and Stephen, I would love to hear your stories, and I'll share mine a little bit too, in terms of your on-ramp. How did you position yourself to hear a call? How did you hear a call? How did you confirm that call? How did you enter into ministry? How did you develop? Love to hear your story. Stephen, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, well, first and foremost for me, I would have to say it's my father. My father was a big influence in my life. He is a pastor turning 80 in August. He's been an independent fundamental Baptist pastor, but has been, you know, my greatest earthly hero and a gift from God to me. He's given me a great view of God. And when people hear me say that, he was not a perfect dad. He is a flawed man, a sinner, saved by grace. But for me, the influence of my father was, I am not like him. I am not his personality. I am very much like my mother. My father can't sing. I can sing. My father stutters. I don't struggle to speak. Like all of those types of, yeah, I saw that, Paul Martin. You can just, yeah, be godly now. Less words is better. but my father modeled this, and he never called me to ministry, but he always put it in front of me. Are you willing if God's calling you? And that was part one. And I think that set me up to want to be taught by others. And then I had an unsaved grandfather who never got saved until 90 days before he died. And, you know, these sages of wisdom, my grandfather was just this like Rolodex of sayings. And one of the things he would always say to me is, Steve, play above your pay grade. Always play with people better than you. At hockey, don't be the best guy, be the worst guy and play with people that are better than you, because then you're always getting better. Mm. And that stuck with me. So even, you know, as God called me into ministry and I went to Bible college, I just gravitated to guys that I felt just did stuff really well. And I wanted to be around them and I wanted to know what made them tick. So for me, though, after salvation, went to Bible college, a guy named Larry Vassour, who was a Greek guy, he was an egghead. I mean, everything opposite for me. He was the size of a gnome. He was not athletic in any way, shape, or form.
He wouldn't be listening to this right now, would he?
Oh, if he is, he'd totally agree. But hands down, this guy just...
He was unattractive.
This guy took me... But honestly, he was a Greek specialist. But he took me under his wing, and I could ask him any question. Because you got to realize, guys, I was raised in this very independent fundamental Baptist world where everything I was told is exact. We know exactly what we believe and why we believe it, and we're right and everybody else is wrong. And then as I studied the Bible, I was just filled with all these questions and all this confusion. And he never panicked. And when I threw stuff at him, and he just brought me into his world. And he, you know, like Paul Martin said, he'd let me pray. He'd let me preach. And he knew I was going to be a train wreck, but he let me do it. He let me sit in meetings. He invited me to stuff. I'd always drive with him in the car when we get to places. And when we leave and go back, he'd say, what did you hear? Who did you think actually was the leader in that meeting? And he'd ask me all the, and I just thought these were tests, but he was teaching me a whole bunch of stuff about, and Paul hits on this. The greatest influence for me is I had a guy who took an interest in me and honestly poured into my life a solid love of the local church. Mm-hmm. He got me convictional about my ecclesiology. And I think that's almost like today, it's the last thing we teach these men. My experience was that was the first thing. So no matter what's happened to me, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent, I have always known that the local church is the means by which God works on this planet. And hurt, no hurt, because we all have our stories, it never, ever crossed my mind that I could abandon the local church. Yeah. It was just a staple of my life. So Larry, my father, my grandfather, and a guy named Larry Vassour, hands down, just shaped who I am today.
Right on. Mm. Paul Martin?
Yeah, I don't recommend my path. I don't understand my own path. I felt the call to the ministry before I was converted. I just kind of always thought
probably that is unusual.
Yeah. And then the first big mentor in my life was my brother-in-law. He's about 12 years older than I am, and the Lord has saved him. And Kent shared the gospel with me. And then I think most young men are just dying for somebody to copy and to imitate. And, you know, that looks like a way of life that I want to follow. And Kent was certainly that for me. And then that led me to California, to the Master's College, first year of that college, a guy named Tim Rafalovich pulled me aside and said, I'm going to mentor you. And I'm like, all right, I don't even know what that is. And, you know, it was let's work on your budget. I didn't have a clue about a budget. Let's work on your schedule. What's a schedule? I'm talking like no life skills right here. And, he just taught me that stuff. He was a USC grad. He was like 4 or 5 years older than me. There was a guy there named Russell Moore, different than the Russ Moore of Southern Baptist world. Huge influence on my life, just spent time with me in his home, that type of thing. And there was a guy named Joel Miller, who's still one of my dearest friends, who was, you know, about 7, 8 years older than me, just showing me how to live life. First guy to get in my kitchen, question my motives, maybe, you know, point out that there was more at play going on than what I was presenting. And then I just, those are guys that were sort of above me, but I feel like I get mentored today by the young interns in the house. Like, amen. I have things to learn from those guys. There's always that give and take of influence. So all of those guys were hugely impactful in my life, and I'm probably leaving out another dozen.
Yeah. That's neat. My story is a little, I guess that's the whole value of sharing these stories, is that all our stories are unusual, and that will allow young people listening to this to imagine a variety of paths that could lead to the ministry.
Or some of them might be wondering right now, am I a garden gnome?
Exactly, right?
Hey, when it comes to you, Martin, I'm a garden gnome. Let's just call a spade a spade.
For me, my start was really unusual. So my parents were led to Christ through a variety of things, but my mom through the Canadian Revival, and then my dad through a pastor that he was connected to through the Canadian Revival. It's a bit of a longer story, but anyway, that pastor, just in the providence of God, happened to also be on the board for this leadership development camp called the Boys Gym Club of America, where they recruit young guys, young kids, like as 8 and 9 years old at the time. You have to try out and you go. And so I tried out for the Boys Gym Club of America and went down with my first sermon memorized that I still have memorized to this day. Dr. Harry M. Lintz, a great evangelist and friend of the gym club, says this about life: nature forms us, school informs us, sin deforms us, but only Jesus Christ can transform us, and so on. And so we would go down, we'd memorize these little sermons, and they would take us around to churches all over the tri-state area. And we would do the program, and the program included music, mime, drama, gospel magic, which is a thing in case you're wondering, and little sermons. And so as a 9-year-old, I preached in 3 different states the summer I was 9 years old: New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. And it was just, that's very unusual. And was there for 2 weeks to 6 weeks of every summer until I think I was 18 or 19. So the challenge for me was I had all these people in my church saying, oh, you should be a minister, because I was almost like the church mascot. I would always do some sort of magic trick for the children's story or whatnot. And so you're just involved in the life of the church and people say you should do it. But I didn't know whether that was true or whether that was just what people were telling me. So I went to Bible school. I went to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago for a year. And I thought I would just kind of read the Bible and talk to other Christians and see. I figured that would be a good place to discern the call of God. I did feel a call to ministry. So I called a pastor friend of mine from home and I asked him, how does one become a pastor? And at Moody, you might say, well, you're already at Moody State. Moody seemed to have more of like a preparing missionaries vibe to me. And so I was open to staying there, but I called my friend and he said, well, come home, go to a university where you'll learn about people and human society and civilization, then go to seminary, learn about God and the church. And ministry is kind of the fine art of connecting the two. Now, I know today, looking back on that, that was actually kind of old school advice. That was advice that was very common in the 60s and 70s. But I received it in the 90s and did it. I'm not sure that's the way I would recommend everybody do it, but that's the way I did it. So I did a university degree in humanities, classics, religious studies, did Attic Greek and all that kind of good stuff, learned Mesopotamian history, and then went to seminary and did all the exegesis and all that kind of stuff. But throughout the end of my university and start of my seminary, I was also interning at churches, and that I would say was even more formative. I remember a guy named Dave Horn who taught me stuff that they would not teach you in seminary, like how to set up chairs. And you think, well, that's stupid. And it's like, no, if you set them too far apart, you lose that sense of community and cohesion. If you put them too close together, people can't stand up. And all the basics and how to do, we used to use clip art.
how to make a handout for a Bible study with clip art and all this, all these kinds of things, how to use a photocopier and how to, and he had me do my first lesson and my first talk to young people, gave me lots of experiences. So all of that combined, you know, led me eventually into the ministry. And, but as I said, it's certainly a winding road. And each of our stories are wonderfully and fabulously different. So hopefully young people can hear something in each of those stories that gives them an idea of an on-ramp. Let's talk to those young people for just a second.
Can I interrupt you again? Can I interrupt you? I recommend a couple of books. This one,
please. But
Path to Being a Pastor, which I think is probably the best thing I've read.
Bobby Jameson,
Path to Becoming a Pastor, Being a Pastor. And The Old Lectures to My Students by C.A.
Amen.
Sir.
Yeah.
In chapter two, where he says, basically, I'm not quoting, but where he says, if you can do anything else, friend, do it.
Yep.
I think there's just great, great wisdom in that Lectures to My Students by C.H. Spurgeon. You can find that one online for free. So read chapter two and that'll help you.
Interestingly, Paul, that is the book, The Night of My Salvation. I was reading that book in chapter one. To be a preacher of grace, you must know the grace yourself.
Amen.
Yeah.
So good. Well, let's talk directly to that 21-year-old who might be listening to this podcast, wondering if God is calling him into the ministry to be a pastor. What would you say to him? What would you recommend that he start doing right away?
Paul? Start being a pastor right now. So people get to know people, shepherd people, care for people, sacrifice, serve the church, be... in my economy, there is no greater compliment to give anyone than to say he's an excellent churchman. And he doesn't have to become an elder to be an excellent churchman or churchwoman, but to understand what membership in a local body is, to love the least amongst us, to be sinned against and handle it appropriately. This is just basic Christianity stuff. And if you're not doing any of that, it kind of goes to the quotes Stephen just alluded to from chapter one in Spurgeon's work. Ministers of the gospel need to understand the gospel, but first of all, they need to be living the gospel. So if you're walking in God's grace and you're actually reading the book and the book tells you to do something and you change your behavior to align up with the scriptures, then you're a guy I'm looking at as potential elder material. If you can open the Bible and read it, and then articulate in some measure what the basic meaning of it is. I'm not saying exegete the text and tell me every nuance of the Greek or the Hebrew, but just say, hey, I read this and it seems to say that. And it's not la la land. You're a guy I'm thinking there may be potential for you. So those would be some basic things.
It's good. Stephen, I'm going to get you to chime in on this, and I've got a thing to say. And then I got one more question. We need to do it all in 8 minutes. So let's hit it.
Very, very quickly, what I would say, Paul told Timothy, if a man desires the office. So here's what I would say to every young man. Have the guts to go and ask, do you have that desire? Are you curious about it? Go talk to your pastor, that mentor, and say, do you see this call? One of the things we say here all the time is, are you God called and church affirmed? So when I'm talking to my young men, the first thing I tell them, I say, listen, number one, and I can't tell you this, are you wrestling with the call, curious about the call? Do you think you're called? You must articulate that to me. Then I can start to speak into your life and we can start to ask your church body, do you see it? What are the deficiencies? How do you know? So I would just tell any young man out there that's a Christian, hey, are you courageous enough to even ask, am I called? Am I curious? Would I? And even if the answer is like, I'm not called. I don't want this. Have the guts to go talk to your pastor about that. At least get that conversation started.
That's good. I love that. God called and church confirmed. That's excellent. And similar to what I would say to that young person, when I was thinking about a call to ministry and trying to figure out, is this real? Was that sense that I had a real thing? I talked to my pastor and he made a brilliant decision. He said, all right, well, let's find out if you're called to be a pastor. Here's two young guys to mentor. And I was in university. So it's a university guy mentoring two guys in junior high. And I met with them every week in one of their basements. Their mom would make us, grilled cheese sandwiches or whatever. We'd have dinner together. we do a Bible study and we talk about life. And it was a really great experience. I developed a great relationship with those two guys. I basically had a church of two, you know, was pastor to two guys, and it worked really well. And from there, they said, yeah, I think you've got some shepherding gifts. Let's go with it. And so that was a confirmation experience. So I would say, similar to what you guys have said, having the sense that God has called you is great. Test it out, get it church confirmed, get it experience confirmed, start doing it, start mentoring some young people. All right. And then the last question, we'll end with this, is if there's a church listening on, and by that, I mean, maybe an elder, maybe a pastor, and they're starting to realize, yeah, we need to be more intentional about leadership development, partly out of self-interest. Like they might say, wow, where are we going to get our next associate pastor? Where, when the current pastor retires, how are we going to get somebody to replace that person? And then maybe they're just also realizing, and this is part of what we're supposed to be doing anyway, disciple making. So whatever the motivation for being interested in this conversation is, what would you say to that person to get started? Paul?
Yeah, I think what I would want to say is you need to read 1 Timothy 3, the elder qualification list, Titus 1, the elder qualification list, 1 Peter 5, elder job description, Acts 20, Paul's description of his ministry amongst the Ephesian Christians. And you need to start thinking in terms of, okay, that is what an elder is. That is who an elder is to be. And if then I'm reverse engineering that. So if my church is full of men who are not gentle, for instance, or are not apt to teach, not able to teach, well, then we got to figure out how we're going to do that. Now, some of that is going to be gifting, obviously. Elders are gifts to the local church, I think, from Ephesians 4. But our role in that is to do as much as we can to facilitate that coming frothing to the surface. So what Steve's been saying all through about calling men to that, calling them to, you know, question that internal call, and then challenging. I think especially for guys, and maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, I think it's true for a lot of women too, but I think especially for guys, if you're to say, hey, I think you could do this, I think you should try it, I want to provoke you, you know, and sort of in the coach sense to push you out a little bit. I think a lot of guys respond to that. So start with the word, build out from there, and call your people to just do what the Bible says.
The only thing I would add to that, Paul, would be what I said at the very beginning. We've got to get away from this Disneyland idea of church that everything is just perfect and you're going to make all the right calls. I have a 26-year-old man here who I think is a gifted young fella. I love him to pieces. I've sat down and told him, you have what it takes to take this church from me. And I would like to let you know.
Challenge accepted.
Which is, you know, and to tell him, I'm going to kick you in the butt a lot harder than most others. And I might be right and I might be wrong, but I'm willing to take that chance. And it helps me. I've told my elders this, hey guys, I want you to keep your eye on this young fella, because I think if God, you know, I'm 52, if God allows me to have this many years, this is a guy who we're growing up within, who's got all the raw talent. He feels the call to ministry, but I don't feel the burden of, well, Steve, what if it's, that's not the guy? Well, 'cause God's God. Yeah, right. Exactly. But my grandfather, again, quoting him, if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time. And so I'd rather be guilty of trying and failing than not trying, because I do think God will overcome that. So I would tell any pastor out there, I think we have too many pastors like the guy, the servant with the one talent. He's afraid of God in an unbiblical way, kind of treats his church as if that's his talent. I just got to maintain this thing till I'm ready to shuffle off, and hopefully God will come along and no. You're supposed to be the guy with the two talents and the five talents, and you're supposed to risk it all every day for the kingdom and God's glory, even if that means it's God's sovereign will for you to cataclysmically fail, because he's still going to be glorified in that, and you're still going to hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant. I think the quicker we get rid of success syndrome as the excuse for not trying, it'll help these pastors of smaller, medium, larger churches of just simply hoarding their little corner and saying, I'll leave the seminaries to figure it out. I'll leave the very alpha male, proactive, extroverted guys who can develop leaders. I'll let them handle it. And hopefully one of those guys will wander over. No, take some chances, risk failure, trust God, because you're not indispensable and you're not irreplaceable. And start having the humility to say, I've got to give this to somebody else.
Yeah, it's good. I'll just summarize what you brother said because I got nothing to add to it. Start training, start calling, start deploying, let the Lord work. And yeah, nothing more to say than that. That's really well said. And hopefully this has been an encouragement to all those who are out there thinking about how do we raise up leaders for the next generation. That's all the time that we have for today. This has been a good conversation. I really appreciate you brothers joining me. We'll be back together again with some panel that we'll put together. To talk about something else that hopefully will be of benefit to local pastors and local churches. If you have a topic in mind that you'd like to send to us, you can go ahead and do that. You can send that to paul@cornerstoneaurelia.org, and we'll put something together and be back with you again shortly. Until then, take care and God bless.
Your word is a lamp unto my feet.